WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Former Harvard president Derek Bok has observed colleges and universities relying more and more on the corporate world for money. He worries that we're getting to the point where everything in the university is for sale, if the price is right. There are new opportunities to sell scientific discoveries to industry and to find corporations willing to underwrite teaching positions and sponsor courses on the internet and cable TV. Bok has written a new book called Universities in the Marketplace, The Commercialization of Higher Education. He's now the faculty chair of the Hauser Center for Nonprofit Organizations at Harvard. I asked Bok why he's concerned that commercialization may be changing the nature of academic institutions.
Well, what has really changed is that the opportunities to make money by the educational programs and research activities of universities have multiplied enormously because advanced research and scientific discoveries are much more valuable to the country and to commercial enterprises. And so what has changed is that there's a lot more patent licensing, there's a lot more education for profit via the internet, and a number of the other practices that I talk about have simply become more numerous.
Are you concerned that if research on the campus is funded by a corporation or by a pharmaceutical company, that research might be less objective because the company might have a vested interest in having the research turn out positively or negatively or whatever?
Well, there are two problems that are worrisome there. One has to do with the fact that often the pharmaceutical company has a given stock or has some other financial arrangement with the researcher or with the university itself. And that creates a conflict of interest, by which I mean that the university and its scientists have a financial stake in the outcome of the research because they will benefit if the research comes out one way and not so much if it comes out another. That threatens the objectivity of the research. But even if the scientists are not hampered in any way by their financial interests, the public will surely lose confidence in the research if they come to know, as they surely will, that a lot of research on university campuses is done by people who have a financial stake in having the outcome come out the right way.
Can you give us an example of an offer that you found very tempting when you were president of Harvard, but you decided to turn it down because you were afraid it would lead to commercialization?
Yes, I can think of one in particular, but there are many others. The one I think of is an offer from a pharmaceutical firm to have Harvard put on a program of new developments in cardiology and receive $1 million a year plus substantial fees for the participating professors, with, of course, commercial advertising at the beginning and end of the program. And in one sense, like so many of these schemes, when you first think about it, the money is very tangible. The risks are pretty ephemeral and intangible and hard to pin down. But the more I thought about it, the more worried I was about, in a sense, going commercial with our teaching programs. Because when you do that, you suddenly introduce another motive into your teaching besides simply trying to educate students. Suddenly, with the commercial sponsorship, everybody knows that you're doing it to earn money. And that makes them begin to mistrust your motives. Is he telling us the real thing? Would the university level with us if products that the sponsor turned out to be bad for your heart? Is the university dumbing down this program in order to make it commercially attractive? Teaching depends on trust, and when you introduce another commercial motive, you make people who you are trying to educate distrust or at least question your motives and wonder whether you're really helping them or only helping yourself. And that's an element of doubt that I think universities should actively try to resist. And so in the end, we turned down the offer.
Was there any pressure on you from the trustees or from anyone else at the university to accept so that you'd get the money?
My trustees were wonderful. They would always back me up on a matter of principle. I never knew them to fail. The deans and faculty members who were immediately involved were disappointed. I don't want to say they brought great pressure to bear. They respected the fact that I was trying to act in a principled way. But they badly needed the money, and so, of course, they were disappointed when I ultimately said, we can't earn our money that way.
One of your concerns has to do with sports, and a lot of colleges and universities have made their reputation with their football or basketball team, and they've made money on those teams as well. So it seems like a pretty good deal for those colleges. You say that it's actually more difficult than you might think to make a profit with a football or a basketball team for college. Why is it difficult?
It's difficult because although if you have a successful team, you may attract a lot of revenue. The costs keep going up very rapidly. Different universities begin enlarging their stadia. They want state-of-the-art weight rooms. They want all-weather practice fields. They want instant videotaping of their practices or the other team's games or 100 other things that drive up the cost. So it's sort of an arms race in which the revenues may be getting greater, but the costs are rising at least as rapidly. What is clear, however, is that there are very real academic costs to becoming a big-time athletic power.
What are some of those costs?
Well, the first place, in order to win on the field, you've got to get the best athletes. The first thing that happens is you compromise your admission standards by letting in lots of students who never would have had a chance of getting in except for the fact that they are effective athletes. And then you begin interfering with the quality of their education in order to further your athletic program by lengthening the seasons, by having practices so long that they cut into the opportunities to study, by having away games. And in all those ways, what you are doing in effect is saying we are prepared to sacrifice our most basic academic standards in order to make money in athletics. And that is really a shameful thing.
So what's the problem really in terms of the larger university? If the athletes on a team are spending a lot of time on the game instead of in class, okay, they're not getting the education that they should theoretically get at that institution. At the same time, you could argue these are people who are going to be focusing on their sport anyways, and this way they're doing it at an academic institution, and it's still benefiting the athletes, and it's certainly benefiting the institution by having the athletes there and by having a good team. So what's the problem? Who's getting hurt?
Well, a number of the student athletes get hurt because they end up being exploited for athletic purposes and the quality of their education suffers. And they may not feel it at the time, but after they graduate, they're less equipped to make their way in the world when the overwhelming majority who can't play professional sports have to make their way in the job market. But more than that, what you've done in athletics is really compromise very basic academic standards. And that results in scandals that hurt the reputation of the university, but it also undermines the value that give meaning to universities for those people who work there, for faculty members who see the admission standards being compromised for a purpose having very little to do with what the university is really there to accomplish, and other students who see people being brought into the university who obviously are not on a par with other students. And in all those ways, I think we suffer, and in the way that any institution that compromises its basic values for money tends to suffer in its own estimation as well as the public's.
My guest is former Harvard president Derek Bok. His new book is called Universities in the Marketplace. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is former Harvard president Derek Bok. His new book is called Universities in the Marketplace: The Commercialization of Higher Education. You end your book with a scenario that you say you fear is just around the corner, and here it is, that Koch approaches, for example, Princeton University with an offer of $25 million for permission to etch five words over the entrance of Nassau Hall. Those five words are, "Things go better with Koch." This is just a hypothetical situation that you dreamed up, but do you think that this could be a reality in the near future? The offer, not Princeton agreeing to it, but the offer.
I don't think the offer would be made because I think they'd know it would be turned down. What I was really trying to do was to illustrate that it's very hard to reason about these cases by using the kind of utilitarian kind of cost-benefit analysis that we often employ in problems of this kind, because the $5 million from Koch is very real and the five words over the entrance are pretty harmless. So what that example does is to make you think more deeply about the fact that it isn't just weighing tangible benefits and costs. There are intangible, subtler values that are nonetheless very important. That if you allow those words to be etched, what you are doing is saying to your faculty and to your students that anything at Princeton can be had for a price. And that is a message which is really insidious because it shakes the faith of students and faculty and the ultimate values of the institution and thus eats away at the kind of morale that makes universities a special place.
Is there anything that you're seeing happening now that isn't things go better with Koch, but it's the same theme that you're talking about, you know, selling out some kind of larger, intangible, but very important value for the upfront money?
Yes, I could give you a number of examples. I think more and more in little ways we're beginning to accept advertising for our educational programs. Now it's sort of creeping in on the internet and in other ways, but the principle is the same. I suppose one of the examples that is perhaps more obvious and dramatic that illustrates the danger to me would be the continuing education of physicians, which is now subsidized to the extent of about 40% by large companies. And those companies, in subtle ways, by offering support of that magnitude, influence what is being taught, how it's being taught. If you get their subsidy, you have to choose from their approved list of instructors. They may provide lecture notes and slides for the instructor. They're going to support some kinds of programs and not others, which tends to affect the mix of programs that you put on for physicians. In all those ways, commerce is beginning to exercise a subtle influence on the content of education, which it really should not.
Do you think that every university president should be puzzling through these issues by himself or herself, or would you like to see some kind of group of university presidents or some kind of ethical committee get together and just puzzle through some of these dilemmas and agree on where the line should be drawn and set an example for all the other colleges and universities?
Well, I certainly think it would be helpful if university officials got together and discussed these things. They're very difficult, and discussion can only help. And there are some situations in which a joint action by a group of universities is much more effective than each individual university going its own way. Most obvious example, of course, again, is athletics. To be completely moral in one's athletic program is to commit unilateral athletic disarmament, and no institution can do that. It's only when you get together as a conference or you get together as the entire NCAA that you have any chance of passing rules to limit the effects of commercialization in a way that will be viable for individual institutions to accept. So, yes, discussion and ultimate agreement in appropriate cases is the most effective way to cure the problem.
What was one of your big frustrations about raising money when you were president of Harvard?
My biggest frustration was that I wasn't very good at it, which is the ultimate frustration. I didn't enjoy it very much. Fortunately, at Harvard, there are lots of people to share the burden, and so I was able to spend a lot of time on the things I love, which are the academic and intellectual problems of the institution. But even so, I had enough fundraising to understand what a problem it is, especially at places that require much more time spent on that purpose than Harvard does.
Dr. Bach, one more question. Has anybody ever said that you sound a little bit like Walter Cronkite?
No, and you make my day by even suggesting that in the minds of your listeners.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Derek Bach is the former president of Harvard. His new book is called Universities in the Marketplace.